This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Susan Sontag died yesterday of complications of leukemia. She was 71. In the obituary, which ran on the front page of the New York Times, Sontag was described as, quote, the novelist, essayist, and critic whose impassioned advocacy of the avant-garde and equally impassioned political pronouncements made her one of the most lionized presences and one of the most polarizing in 20th century letters, unquote. One of her best-known books was called Illness as Metaphor. In the late 70s, Sontag was described with breast cancer. She underwent chemotherapy and several operations. Her sickness led her to think about the punitive and sentimental images that we use to describe sick people and their illnesses. Those observations led to her book Illness as Metaphor. In 1989, she wrote a follow-up called AIDS and Its Metaphors. When it was published, I asked her why she was still interested in analyzing the metaphors we use to discuss illness.
Metaphors are just ways of tracking attitudes. So what interests me, in fact, isn't, in this instance, verbal. I'm not that kind of linguistic purist. I'm not trying to make people clean up their language out of some idea of how language ought to be. What interests me is that metaphors and turns of speech are carriers of very deep attitudes, and it's the attitudes that matter. And a lot of the attitudes, I think, are wrong, false, misleading, and punishing, particularly to patients.
You wrote Illness as Metaphor after you had cancer, and when you had cancer, what about the language that was used around you by your doctors, perhaps, started to make you really conscious of the language that we use to describe illness and people who are sick?
Well, I became a cancer patient in the late 70s, and my cancer was diagnosed as terminal, so I not only found out, to my surprise, I had cancer, I found out that I was going to die, which, as it turned out, I didn't. And the discovery was not even so much the language the doctors used, although I quickly became aware of that, too. It was when I started to live mainly in hospitals and I discovered how ashamed people with cancer were of the illness, how they concealed it from their employers and friends and family members. And it wasn't just an illness. It seemed to be some kind of embarrassment or scandal. And so that was indeed the origin of that book, which I thought was the last book I would ever write. But I did get very good treatment, and I was cured.
Did the doctors use language that you thought ended up victimizing you in some way or that you were uncomfortable with?
No, I don't. It really came... the doctors viewed me as odd, first of all, because I was asking for more treatment when they didn't want to give me a lot of treatment because they thought I was terminal, and also because I wanted to learn about the illness because I'm a naturally curious person. And they said, oh, you know, we've never seen somebody who was so interested. And I said, why shouldn't I be interested? I mean, as my life is on the line. And, well, usually people don't want to know about their treatment or about the illness. And I think that people are more curious about, let's say, diabetes or MS or heart or cardiac illness than they are about. They were really spooked by cancer. It's less true now, but it certainly was true 10 years ago when I was sick.
Why do you think it's less true now?
Well, for one thing, we have a more terrifying disease, a disease which is, I say in my new book that it seems as if our society or our kind of society needs a disease which is demonized, and then by extension there is an imputation of fault or guilt to the patient. But although we need to do this with illnesses, make them symbolic or metaphoric and moralize about them, it's make them into a scandal. We perhaps only have place for one illness at a time, and that certainly was for generations cancer. And now I think it is AIDS. I think AIDS has become the great symbolic illness of our time, to which all sorts of interesting attitudes are attached, including our very attitudes toward the future and toward disaster and toward behavior of all kinds, which is why I thought it was worth writing another essay about, another small book about attitudes toward illness, about AIDS as such, I don't think I have anything so original to say. I mean, it's a terrible disease. I've lost many friends to it. I think people should get good treatment. I think there is better treatment than most people are getting, et cetera, et cetera. I think there should be lots more money for research. Those are, you know, I have the standard, I think, correct attitudes that many other people have. the contribution that I can make in my book is to explore all the attitudes associated with this illness. Concerns about pollution, for instance, and contamination that reinforce the horror of the disease. I mean, the disease is bad enough. Any serious illness that's life-threatening is bad enough. But why should people feel guilty? Why should they feel as if they are carriers of evil? And they do. And they do with AIDS, and they have with cancer.
What language do you use to describe the fact that you don't have cancer anymore? And what I mean is, some people say, I triumphed over cancer. I fought the battle and won. You really hate military metaphors when it comes to disease, and that's something you point out in illness as metaphor and AIDS and its metaphors. So when you, if someone asks you about your condition and you say that you no longer have cancer, what words do you use?
Well, I say I was cured because I struggled with the help of friends to get into a very high-powered, advanced medical situation where I was in an experimental, you know, I was a guinea pig for some new drugs, which subsequently, of course, have been adopted, but they were still in an experimental stage. And I'm not averse to saying, I mean, I'm too modest, perhaps, in my language to want to say I triumphed about anything. That's not a word that comes easily to mind. To me, and you know, say I triumph. I tend to say, well, I did okay. But I would say, I fought for my life. I did. I don't say I fought the disease because that sounds corny. But I would say I really wanted to live. I really wanted to live. I was in no way an accomplice of this disaster. I didn't say, you know, well, there's a part of me that doesn't want to live, and I wanted to do everything I could. I struggled. I don't think, you see, metaphors of struggle are wrong, because I think life is in part a struggle. I'm not against metaphoric language as such, but personally, of course, I have no difficulty in saying, yes, I fought for my life. I did.
A lot of people who have faced life-threatening illness and survive talk about how it really changed their lives, how their priorities changed, the way they spend their time changed. Did anything like that happen to you?
Absolutely. Oh, sure. It's absolutely a turning point in my life. I think it was actually a positive experience. It may sound strange to say it. There are a lot of things I didn't like about it, like scaring people who love me, particularly my son, who went into a sort of deep despair when he thought that I was going to die, and that was certainly a wound in his life. And I didn't like, you know, being cut up and mutilated in operations, and I didn't like a lot of other things. And yet, I think it was a positive experience. I think it was a deepening experience. It's put me more in contact with myself, I don't think it didn't make me into a different person, but it released things that were inhibited, like I have more access to my own gift for intimacy, if I can put it in such an indirect and shy form. I find it easier and more necessary to express feeling for other people. I mean, I had those feelings, but I was more inhibited before. And when I was very ill, in the years I was very ill, I mostly spent that time holding hands, as it were. People gathered around me. They were wonderful. A number of people came through for me in the most magnificent way, and I felt that holding hands and being with people and laughing and crying together was a tremendous, exalting experience. I had just euphoric moments in this period of being ill. And people who were with me felt that, too. I mean,
So you've kept that intimacy.
I have, to some extent, right.
Why was it something that you didn't have before? Was it a time thing, or did you think that it was too sentimental to express intimacy that way?
I think I had a very emotionally very deprived childhood. I was left to myself when I was a child. My father died when I was 5, and I really never knew him, and my mother was away most of my childhood. So I think I have a little bit still, a bit the psychology of an orphan. And so I would be afraid of showing feeling because of being afraid of rejection. It's something so deep, you know, and so primal. You know it's not true, but somewhere deep down, you just don't feel that people are going to love you, because if you didn't feel loved when you were 2 or 3 years old, it's very hard to come to that later on. It's a kind of acquired confidence. It doesn't... I mean, I see my son, for instance, who knows himself to have been much loved when he was a small child. He's now an adult. He just has a different way of relating to people. I mean, because there's some basic confidence that you have when you feel that you're loved when you're a very tiny child that you can't have. Or anyway, you have to do a lot of work to acquire it. And I had to do a lot of work. I'm in my 50s now, and I think I'm just beginning, and partly due to my illness experience, to get over the wounds of that sort of feeling of being an orphan or being an abandoned or rejected child.
Susan Sontag, recorded in 1989. We'll listen back to an excerpt of a 1993 interview with Sontag after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering essayist, novelist, and critic Susan Sontag. She died yesterday of leukemia. In 1993, during the war in the Balkans, Sontag risked her life by going to Sarajevo, where she directed a production of Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. She found only 2 existing theaters and no functioning theater companies. After she returned, she spoke to Fresh Air guest host Marty Moscoane.
How multi-ethnic was the cast and the crew? Were there Muslims, Croats, Serbs working together on this play?
Absolutely, and I made no effort to choose people on that basis, but gradually, as I got to know them, I found that I had, you know, absolutely a mix. I had people who were completely Serb, completely of Muslim origin, and completely Croat. And I had more than half the people who were of mixed parentage, a Muslim mother and a Serb father, or Croat mother and a Muslim father, etc. It was because that's what Sarajevo is. And one of the most interesting facts about Sarajevo that I know is in the year before the war started, in April 92, 60% of the marriages in Sarajevo were intermarriages. I think that tells you a lot about the city.
What language, then, was the play done in?
The play was done in Bosnian, because that's the language the actors speak, although many of them do speak English. They don't act in English, and anyway, the audience, I want this play to be understood by the audience. That may seem odd to you, but it's really not odd. I mean, Arthur Miller went to Shanghai and directed a production of Death of a Salesman. He certainly directed it in Chinese, not in English. So just a theater director, like an opera director with any experience and any international experience, knows how to do this in a foreign language. All you need is an interpreter. And I used one of the actors who was bilingual as my interpreter. And I could communicate privately with most of the actors in English. But the language in which they spoke the text was Bosnian. And what I did was I had 2 copies of the script. I had an English language copy of Mr. Beckett's script enlarged. And I wrote the Bosnian word by word above the English, and then I had a copy of the Bosnian text, and I wrote the English above it word by word. And after about 2.5 weeks, I could recite the play for you in Bosnian, because I heard it so many times. And I always knew what they were saying, and I could say, you know, that line you're saying too fast or not expressively or whatever. It's no different, really, from opera directing, which also takes place in many languages.
What was it like to work with a cast and crew that I'm sure were hungry a lot of the time, certainly were frightened a lot of the time, probably many of them didn't even feel well because of the conditions they were living under?
Yeah, what it was that I was pretty easygoing at the start, and maybe I was easygoing all the way through, keeping my fingers crossed that I'd still get a good result at the end. 1 or 2 people said to me, who came in and watched rehearsals, it's funny, I've never told this to anybody, said, you're too nice to them. Don't you know a director has to scream at people now and then and be terrifying and tyrannical?
Are you that kind of a director anyway?
Well, first of all, I'm neither that kind of director nor that kind of person, but I knew that I couldn't scream at these people even if I wanted to. They were so gallant and so tired, and they all had terrible stories, and I noticed how tired they were because they would sit down or lie down every time I stopped the rehearsal for 1 minute to give a correction or suggestion. They'd immediately all drop into chairs or drop to the floor. And actors don't do that. I mean, they stay in place when you talk to them, unless it goes on and on and on. And I wasn't stopping them for more than a minute or two.
So they had no stamina, really.
They had no stamina at all. And the character of Lucky in Beckett's play is a figure of a man who carries a lot of suitcases. He's the figure of a burdened person. And needless to say, the suitcases that the actor playing Lucky in my production was carrying were all empty. And he was having a very hard time carrying empty, very light suitcases, two or three.
You certainly are describing the desperate conditions in Sarajevo and describing the deep depression that many of the people feel. How are they able to go on with their life? How much of a life do they really have?
Well, you know, as many people have said in literature and in ordinary life, people get used to anything. This is both a horrible and an exalting aspect of human nature. You would be surprised at the degree of normality there. I remember when I went in April, I couldn't believe that I saw children playing on the streets. And I met parents, and I said, how do you let your children go out on the streets? Because something like three or four children are minimum are killed every day by sniper bullets or by mortar shells fragments. And they said, look, you can't keep your children indoors after 16 months. You can keep them indoors for 2 weeks or a month or 2 months, but life goes on, except it's Russian roulette. It's a shooting gallery, except you could be killed at any single moment of the day or night, wherever you are, and you have in most, almost all places in the city, including the one functioning hotel, which is where I stayed, no water at any time, no electricity at any time, and very, very little food.
What precautions did you take to make sure that, not make sure, but to try to protect yourself against the sniper bullets?
None.
None. Why not? Why not?
Because I think I cannot work with people there wearing a flak jacket. I will tell you, I do own one. Because in order to get on a UN plane, which is the only way you can get in or out of the city, is by a plane run by the United Nations, which carries soldiers or cargo, it's a rule that you have to wear a flak jacket. So I actually possess one of these things. I wore it to get on the plane in Zagreb, and I got off the plane with it at the Sarajevo airport, which is controlled by the Serbs. But there's a little UN revetment, and I wore it into the city, and I checked into the hotel, and I left it there, and I put it on again 6 weeks later when I went out to the airport to get on the plane. That may seem very foolish, but I felt that I could not come to rehearsal, sit with my actors wearing armor, when no one in the city has a flak jacket, and no one is protected in the way all foreigners, that is journalists or anybody visiting the city, is. So that was a moral decision. I felt like I absolutely could not do that, that I'm putting myself in a different position. No one told me to do that except one actor about 4 days into the rehearsal process said to me, of course I wouldn't mind if you wore a flak jacket, but I do appreciate that you don't. But that was the only person who ever said to me that noticed it, but I'm sure everybody noticed it. I felt it was a question of principle, not to live differently from the way they live.
Susan Sontag speaking with Fresh Air guest host Marty Moscowane in 1993. Sontag died yesterday of complications from leukemia. She was 71. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with actor Jerry Orbach. He died last night of prostate cancer. This is Fresh Air.